building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Michael Nagler, and today is Friday, March 4th, 2016. On our show, we are going to be talking with Dr. David Ragland, and he grew up in North St. Louis, just a few miles from Ferguson, Missouri, and he's the co-founder of what is called the Ferguson Truth-Telling Project, and this is really what we want to emphasize on. What does truth and reconciliation, what is the role of truth and reconciliation processes in getting to a nonviolent future, and what are some of the forms that they're taking? And so Dr. Ragland will talk to us about this project in particular. And he's an assistant professor of peace and conflict studies, and he's also on the board of the Peace and Conflict Studies Association, and author and writer. We're very pleased to have him on Peace Paradigm Radio. Welcome, Dr. Ragland, to Peace Paradigm Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we are very interested in truth and reconciliation processes, and we've talked about them before on Peace Paradigm Radio. Can you talk to us, can you give our listeners who may be new to this idea a sense of, first of all, what that even means? What is a truth and reconciliation process, and what might be some of the history about them?
Right. So most people are familiar with South Africa, mm-hmm. particularly after the apartheid regime ended officially with the release of Nelson Mandela, and he went to Bishop Tutu. And to avoid basically what would have been a civil war, and for the minority black population and, the majority black population and minority white population. And often truth and reconciliation processes or commissions are usually from the top down. And so the state is really interested in what could be very divisive issues, usually post-conflict situations. I would say that our approach is very different. We're interested in some of the formulating or underlying currents of truth and reconciliation, which is healing and truth-telling as an important aspect, because we have to, number one, identify what happened in community. And then at the same time, these processes, often the commission happens, but the process is very different than the actual structural commission because they're often influenced by the needs and interests of the state itself to continue and maybe in a different formation. And some of the outcomes of truth and reconciliation commissions has often been reparations. Some have been formal, where people who committed atrocities have actually been found guilty or been testified against, or there's been forgiveness for, particularly in Rwanda, after the genocide of the Tutsis and the Hutus. You had two very close communities that turned against each other, one massacred the other, and it often happened with neighbors. So how do you deal with a large conflict where neighbors are often perpetrators? And it's also been used for child soldiers, for people who, for young people who are forced into service, and they don't have a choice to fight. So those processes have also helped to reintegrate them into communities.
Dr. Ragland, that is fascinating. I have a question for you. Were there, actually two questions, were there African precedents for the TRC before Messrs. Tutu and Mandela instituted it in South Africa?
You know, I'm not necessarily sure, but that is a good question. And, you know, some of the as we were developing and researching our work, I would say that the notions of reconciliations are rooted in the phrase Mbuntu, but also some of the traditions of community reconciliation and some of the configurations of restorative justice, which had always been present in many communities from around the world. So on one hand, as a formalized process, it gained notoriety popularity and interest after South Africa. But then those processes had always been present, and they were many. You know, I can't point to a specific large truth and reconciliation process in Africa that I identify with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Dr. Ragland, I spent a couple years in West Africa as a Peace Corps volunteer during the George Bush fiasco, and because I wanted to learn more about Islam, and there were reasons why I went. But one of the things that I really learned in the community that welcomed me was that idea that we are all living here together, and that we can't isolate somebody out of our community. We have to find ways of reintegrating people, even when we're mad at them, even when there's things that have happened that have affected the community negatively. There are processes in place that are very much aligned with those of restorative justice, which I didn't learn until much later. And while I was there, I was sent a DVD called In My Country, which also it was about the truth and reconciliation process, and from the perspective of a journalist, Ike Krog, and in South Africa. And I remember watching how the producer of the film said she just wanted people to know there were such things as truth and reconciliation commissions. And that was really an aha for me. And I said, what? I have never heard of this before. You know, I was still young, and I didn't know anything else besides, you know, you go to jail, or that, you know, this is the kind of retributive justice systems that we've learned about. So what about you? Where were you when you first learned about truth and reconciliation? And then really, what brought you then into this truth-telling project?
That's an interesting question. And I'm not sure where I was, but, you know, I did follow closely South Africa when I was younger. I remember being in middle school and watching the Spike Lee movie School Days, and the focus was on divestment in Africa, divestment of South Africa. And after that, I was very much tuned into restorative justice, and particularly South Africa. But I want to go back to the earlier question from Michael, which was really interesting and important. And I want to point out the Navajo Nation. And the Navajo Nation, as an indigenous, using indigenous approaches to seeking justice. And also restorative justice. And we should be very clear for people listening that that the different types of justices are restorative, which is looking at how do we look at the root causes of harm and restore what was lost repair a relationship, and truth and reconciliation is an approach to that. But then also there's retributive and distributive. And retributive, we know an eye for an eye, but distributive is also connected. How are goods and rights in a society distributed? And that can be a restorative issue as well. And so August the 9th, when Michael Brown was killed, is my mother's birthday. And I was in St. Louis at my parents' house, and at the time I was teaching at Bucknell. And I had just actually taught a summer class, Education for Peace and Justice, and I had taken my students to D.C., and this was right at the beginning or right around the time of the Israeli incursion into Palestine and the disastrous effects of that war against the Palestinians and that protracted conflict. And I came to St. Louis, and I didn't yet know Michael Brown was killed, but my friends were like, I was telling them about how, the work in Palestine and an article that I had just written, and they told me, well, this young brother just got killed. It was a good friend of mine in St. Louis. And so right then, we went out there. And then a few weeks later, I actually stayed even longer and asked my college, could I stay, because I was worried because Jimmy Powell had just got killed across the street from my parents' house by police. And so we were worried about, number one, what would happen, and I just didn't want to leave my parents. They're both retired and older. And I remember actually one of my colleagues, Michael, you probably know him, but I won't say his name, called me and asked, what are you doing? What are you doing? And I had been going out to the protest, and I had been talking to people, and I had my academic hat on for some reason. I was interviewing, but I was also just listening and in awe that people were standing up and not letting this thing go down without speaking up. But, people had withdrawn their consent from the authorities. And so when my friend called, we began talking about what was possible. And I went to my mentor, Tony Neal, who was the principal of the East St. Louis High School. And he had mentored me when I was a high school student. And we began talking and then talking with groups and then talking with other organizations like the Peace and Justice Studies Association. And we eventually came up with the idea of the Truth Telling Project because, it went through many iterations, but in conversations with many people from our community, we were talking about reconciliation, and people weren't interested in reconciliation in that sense, because when we think about truth and reconciliation, it's post-conflict. And people are still getting killed across this country by police. We thought that it was an important space to begin conversations, but also that people can speak out. People who've lost family members by the hands of the police, those narrowly focused African Americans lost family by the police. And number one, so that the accounts can be set straight from people's voices, not talking head academics like myself, but people like my mom and my cousins and people like my neighbors would get a chance and be heard, because America has not yet really listened.
For those of you just tuning in, you're at Peace Paradigm Radio, and we're talking with Dr. David Ragland about the inspiration that came to the creation of the Truth-Telling Project in Ferguson. But the project is to address racism and structural violence for Ferguson and beyond. And we're looking at it from a perspective of the processes of truth and reconciliation. And so Dr. Raglan was giving us a deeper insight into what some of the approaches that they had to begin with, or the inspiration, where to begin. And it's based in this idea of being heard and being able to speak and to talk about an issue that's facing a community, because most truth and reconciliation processes happen post-conflict. And what do you do when you're within the conflict? And so they're looking at it from a creative angle and saying, how do we adapt this process to deal with where we are now? Does that summarize, Dr. Raglan, your points, do you feel?
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Michael?
Yeah, David, I wanted to run a couple of things by you. You know, our mutual colleague, Rachel McNair, studies what she calls perpetration-induced traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. So I want to put in the idea here for its practical value that a policeman who has lost his head and shot somebody to death that was unarmed, that police officer also is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And truth and reconciliation, excuse me, can help heal him and make him, or conceivably her, a better player in the whole process of restoration. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, very much so. And we actually had those conversations. And, you know, and I just need to stress that we see truth-telling as a first step. Mm-hmm. And this is this is not just police violence. You know, so on one hand, we're looking at it narrowly, but what's been coming out of testimony is a history, you know, of being targeted by police, family members incarcerated, a whole American history of, you know, essentially from the plantations to prison. And, you know, when we look at the prison population, a large percentage are Black and Latino in this country. We have to really stop and think about the systemic processes and even the individual choices and behaviors that essentially set up, you know, a situation where this is possible in the wealthiest, most industrialized nation in the country. And so on one hand, the specific position of truth-telling in terms of Ferguson is we always listen to police. As a matter of fact, we're more likely to believe what police tell us. But when is it? When is the truth or the experience coming from communities ever listened to and valued as something that's truthful or even important for us to make policy decisions based on? And I think that's something that America needs. And so when we think about even the notion of equity, what does it take for groups who've been historically traumatized and historically disenfranchised to actually become equal? So we have to think about the notion of power in terms of truth and reconciliation, but specifically we front load the notion of power as we try to move forward and do some kind of process that will be helpful. And I just want to reiterate that it is the first step. And I really think we need multiple decades of this. But at the same time, you know, we need a large American process that actually deals with the historical injustices, you know, or the founding acts. And America has been so willing to be silent about it. As a matter of fact, Joseph Ellis, in his book, Founding Brothers, writes, in one of the chapters is called Silence. And what he points out is how the founding fathers actually decided that they would strike from the record that they had discussions about the moral issues connected to slavery and revolution, that they wouldn't even have it, that they talked about it until those founding fathers died. And in part, because the reason for maintaining slavery was about political expediency and economics, well, primarily economics. So how do you justify to the American populace at that time that we made this decision when the values of the Continental Congress and the founding of the country and revolution is about freedom and liberty, when a large percentage of the population are enslaved? And so that founding act of silence bleeds into where we are now as a society, and it has to be addressed. We have to ask ourselves, when do we put the fire out in this burning house?
Thank you, Dr. Raglan. Now, that was really beautiful, and it's really important that we contextualize this within the framework as well of nonviolence, because that's really what we're trying to do on the show. And so what I'm hearing is that, you know, the emphasis on truth within the restorative justice process of Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it reminds me then of Satyagraha, the idea that, you know, the primary importance of nonviolence, as Gandhi saw it, for example, was truth. Holding Satyagraha means holding on to the truth. And that truth has a power in itself. And when we can open ourselves and create spaces and processes where we're able to listen and hear them, then that truth has a power on us to be able as well to transform our actions, our minds, and our behaviors toward a more just form of relating to one another. And when I think as well of what I've heard about truth and reconciliation processes in the past, usually there's also, as you were saying before, there's problems with them, and that it's almost sped through to get to the reconciliation. Now let's forget about that these things happened, and maybe even let's forget about what we promised at the end of this commission too. Let's just like put this behind us now that you've had your turn. And so the emphasis on, by shifting the emphasis from reconciliation and saying that could come later, but shifting it to the truth, I think is also very interesting. That the focus is not so much on the reconciliation aspect, which might surprise people and it might make them uncomfortable. But that's also okay if people feel a little bit uncomfortable, because
America needs to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. I can say more about that.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, people are uncomfortable with anger, you know, or like anger over righteousness, you know, like, so, you know, I'm opposed to violence, you know, which is why I teach in this area and committed my life to peace. But justice is the larger part. If we think about how peace is comprised, it's a violence. Otherwise, if you don't get justice and you try to end the violence, you don't ever get out of the situation of that possibility of violence. And I think that, you know, as a society, you know, we're much more willing to push things under the rug. And I think that's why a lot of people like Bernie Sanders on one hand, and they like Donald Trump on the other hand, because he's giving people permission to say whatever it is that they want, even if it is violent and hateful toward other people. But, you know, but that part is rooted in, you know, some of the basis aspects of our society without care for others. But our project is rooted in, number one, love for ourselves, and the fact that, you know, it is a matter of human dignity to be able to speak one's truth, to be able to say what it is they're feeling. And people are just talking about their own experiences. You know, this is what happened to me. This is what I go through every day. You know, people desire for, at least the folks who were speaking truth, when we launched the hearings in Ferguson in November, people were very happy to be able to speak. And Fania Davis, Angela Davis's sister, was there, and she runs Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, and she's also engaged in a nation nationwide, working on something nationwide in terms of truth and reconciliation processes. But she was telling me, she stood next to me and said, you know, this is healing in itself. And I think you know, we need to come together and heal. And one thing about when we had our hearings this past November, and we're going to have them throughout 2016, we also did something that we learned from the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation, and it was called Night of a Thousand Conversations. And what that looked like was we streamed people's testimony out to communities from around the country that had organized, and we provided them with toolkits so that they can actually facilitate discussion and actually develop action plans based on the discussions that were had. And so on one hand, there's this truth that makes people uncomfortable, but part of it is, what am I going to do with this truth? How does that change my behavior? How does that change the way that I look at the world? And so it's not about making people feel guilty. It's about, you know, it's kind of like when you learn you have an eating problem. What do you need to do? You have to pick things in your diet that are going to help you. You have to put yourself in situations that you're going to eat in the right kinds of food or things that don't give you high blood pressure. And I think, you know, part of this is healing America. You know, how do we look at our history? How do we look at what we have now? How do we examine our past and plot out a better course for not only for us, but for the world? Because, you know, in Ferguson during the October uprising, one of the people from the Palestinian delegations, her name is Sahad Kattab, and she said, if black folk truly get free in the U.S., then the rest of the world has a possibility. So what does it look like for America acting justly in its own borders? And that acting justly is connected to all kinds of issues, environmental degradation. It's connected to housing issues. It's connected to food, because we know poor and disenfranchised communities are often more likely to get the worst end of the stick, to more likely to be subject to bad environmental conditions, like what's happening in Flint right now.
Absolutely. Yes. So seeing the interconnection behind our actions and behind the need for justice. But the potential of a truth and reconciliation process is that it's working for justice through means that are attempting to, as you said, heal instead of to create further divides. And because it's been tried, it's been researched, and people are getting really creative with it. And it's very exciting that it's happening here in the U.S. where it can be so helpful for making the United States a more healed place in order to address the structural violence in our midst. Dr. Ragland, how can people find out more about the Truth Telling Project?
I would say go to www.truthtellingproject.org. We have an event coming up in New York at Symphony Space on March 24th called Voices of Freedom. And Reverend Sekou and the Holy Ghost will be performing. So it's truth through performance, as well as a renowned singer, opera singer, Allison Cambridge, African-American soprano, and many other folks. And that's going to be March 24th, Symphony Space. And you can see more about that on our website or Twitter at Truth Tellers USA. And that's, again, at Truth Tellers USA.
Thank you so much, Dr. Reglan, for joining us on Peace Paradigm Radio today to talk about the Truth Telling Project. And we hope that you will be able to join us again at a later date to follow up on this conversation we just were able to start with you.
Thank you so much, Stephanie and Michael. It was so good to hear your voice again. I look forward to talking with you soon.
I've got something I want to run by you, actually, David. So, yes,
all right.
Let's talk
about that. Sounds great. That sounds great. Looking forward to it.
Peace. We hope that you've enjoyed the show so far, but now we want to move into another really fun thing that we get to do on Peace Paradigm Radio, which is nonviolence in the news. Because, again, where do you hear these stories? Here on Peace Paradigm Radio. Michael.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. Yeah, and as usual, we have what they call in French, un embarras de richesse. There's just too much to talk about, but I'm going to pare it down. And I nonetheless want to make a bit of a pitch here for our pledge drive, our fund drive. You know, there's a very important book, really kind of a seminal book for understanding our culture and its situation today. It's by an educator, an educational philosopher by the name of Neil Postman. And the book, it's not a new book, it's called Amusing Ourselves to Death. Now, in that book, Postman documents how this process of degeneration in American mass media happened. And interestingly enough, it was caused partly by technology. That is, when the telegraph came in, you could suddenly be reading in the newspaper if you were, say, out here during the gold rush in California. You could be reading exciting items that were taking place in Boston. And in other words, those were items which had no direct relevance for you, and there was nothing you could do about it. And so the shift began from news and empowerment to amusement. Entertainment. So this is to underscore the importance of local radio, of community radio. So do be thinking about that. I am now going to wander all over the world searching for interesting nonviolent news. As usual, we start off with a couple of resources, and this time it's a couple of books. One of them has just been mentioned by Stephanie because it's available to listeners who make a pledge of $50. It's by Iyad Bernat. His brother, Emad Bernat, created the film Five Broken Cameras. So this is a remarkable family. We've met Iyad several times. He's a good friend. And he writes a book now called Bil'in and the Nonviolent Resistance, which is not just an eyewitness account, but the account by a participant, a daily participant, in the struggles of a West Bank village which actually had some success. They managed to force the Israeli Supreme Court to get the building of the apartheid wall shifted most of the way out of their land, which is, you know, just totally illegal from start to finish. Anyway, I've just finished reading the book, and what really struck me about it is the spirit of these people. They are so underprivileged in terms of weapons, in terms of international awareness, except, of course, for what goes on KWMR and Peace Paradigm Radio. But they are gifted with a tremendous spirit of resistance and human dignity. And they say over and over again, we are not against Jews, we are against the occupation. So, unfortunately, the only way that book is available is now if you were to purchase it through the Meta Center or get it through KWR as part of your reward for pledging. Another book that's appearing now is by Mark and Paul Engler. It's called This is an Uprising: How Nonviolent Revolt is Shaping the 21st Century. Reading you a little bit from their description. From protests around climate change and immigrant rights to Occupy, the Arab Spring, and Black Lives Matter, a new generation is unleashing strategic, nonviolent action to shape public debate and force political change. They come up with the phrase transformative unrest, which I think is a very, very apt one. If you think of Paul Hawkins' Blessed Unrest, it fits in very nicely. They look at the groundbreaking figures like Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Gene Sharp, and Francis Fox Piven, And they show how with few resources, as I was just saying, and little conventional influence, they are engineering the upheavals that are reshaping contemporary politics. More information on thisisanuprising.org. One word. Upcoming events in the San Francisco on March 15th. There's going to be a celebration of Betita Martinez at Modern Times bookstore in the city. There's a Facebook event for it, but you can also look up the Modern Times SF hashtag. And this is someone who had a great deal of experience in the the Latino worker struggle in California, and it should be an extremely interesting review of her life and her book. Now, there's another opportunity headed our way, and I have to say partly as a result of the Meta Center, and that is our very good friend Rivera Sun is going to be in our area this month. She's teaching workshops and giving talks on nonviolence. The workshops could be on campaign nonviolence, on exploring nonviolent cities, which is a project of a campaign nonviolence, on the concept of the movement of movements, which we talk about and write about a great deal. How are we going to coalesce these wonderful projects that are spread all over the country and the globe into an unstoppable movement? And finally, a workshop called Seeds of Change, Strategy for Action. We have seen Rivera in action at these workshops. They are inspiring and informative, and you can find out about it by contacting us at the Meta Center or by contacting the Sonoma County Peace Center. And also, in the local area, in accordance with Neil Postman's directive, the film Consumed with Danny Glover is going to have a special screening on the 10th in Rohnert Park. Find out more about it at gathr.us/screening/14154. The film is about consumerism and especially about GMO foods that we're consuming. There's also, more distantly, a two-week residential immersion training coming up at the River Phoenix Center for Peacebuilding in Gainesville, Florida, just to show you that we are not narrow-minded parochial West Marin lovers, though we partly are. So there will be a retreat there which covers much of what they've been advocating for many years at the Peace Alliance, and we have a little more time for those. They'll be May 6th to 14th and October 14th to 22nd, and that is going to give us an opportunity for a real immersion experience in nonviolence training. You know, as we've often emphasized, we think that training is, well, you could look at it as the weakest link or as the link where there's most opportunity for development in the world of peace these days.
Now, Michael, you were just talking about the importance of training, and so many nonviolent actions have happened without necessarily training happening, that they have been spontaneous, and then people get involved. Now, I see the importance of training. I can see two, at least I should have three reasons, but let's start. Maybe you can find the third. The first is that when spontaneous movements happen and you're involved, it's important then to learn how to maintain nonviolent discipline. And so, you know, you might get involved at first, but then in order to continue the nonviolence, a little bit of training, including strategic training and strategy training and understanding nonviolence as a concept better, which it requires some discussion and working out in terms of your community, because it's all about community. So that's the first reason. And then the second one is that, let's see, we have the maintaining nonviolent discipline and then keeping it going after the feeling has washed away or after the repression has come and gone. And then what? So in terms of continuing a struggle, can you think of a third reason for training?
Yes, I can. There's a second problem which is faced by uprisings today and movements today, and that is if they want to be nonviolent, and that is how to deal with people who don't. And people who are not committed to nonviolence, which I suppose they deserve to make that commitment. It's their right. Nonetheless, when they mix it up with a nonviolent movement, it has a very powerful spoiling effect. Think of 1999. Think of the Battle of Seattle. You had like 50,000 pretty well-trained nonviolent resistors in the streets. They're being very effective. And you had, what, I don't know, maybe two dozen persons who are not committed to nonviolence, who broke windows, who burned tires, who did things like that. And needless to say, it was on those people that the press, that the media focused. That's their instinct. But even without the media covering it and exaggerating it in that way, it has a devastating effect on a nonviolent protest. So I think any action that we want to take, we must be able to come up with a way to deal with the violent element, or what's sometimes called, diversity of tactics, or the violent flank. And incidentally, in their really groundbreaking book, Erica Chenoweth and Maria Steffen have launched investigations that others have carried forward, like Kurt Schock and other investigators, into what is the effect of a violent flank in a nonviolent movement. Now, we know from watching the film Selma that a violent flank can be held in reserve as a kind of threat, so that, as President Kennedy said, those who make nonviolent revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. So it can have somewhat of a bracing and a contextualizing effect that, gee, if you don't deal with us, you're going to have to deal with people who are much more damaging. But beyond that, and as a general rule, the violent flank is a detriment to a nonviolent movement. So all those three things that we're talking about, how to maintain nonviolent discipline, and I would say maybe most important of all, what part of the whole process is this, as Dr. Raglan was just saying? Where do we go from here? If we're defeated, where do we go? If we're not defeated, where do we go from here? Because that way you capture the spontaneous energy, which we sometimes call effervescence of the crowd, and launch a momentum that can really mean long-lasting change. And then thirdly and finally, how to keep others from disrupting what you've created.
Anything else on the nonviolence news for our listeners?
Oh, indeed. I have some items here. I'm not sure how to categorize them, but PopularResistance.org, a source that we often turn to for these items, has done something very interesting this week. They have kind of followed in the footsteps of Yes Magazine and gone around the world looking for ways that, quote, other countries are actually solving problems. Now, for those of you who have seen or are thinking of seeing Michael Moore's latest movie, you will know that, unfortunately, there is more wisdom to be gained and more practical insights to be gained and more encouragement to be gained outside the U.S. in some ways than inside today. So I'm going to go quickly, just mention what these 10 things are, and you can go to PopularResistance.org to find out more about them. In Peru, by the year 2013, only about two-thirds of the 25 million people had access to electricity. So they have brought in a free solar-powered electricity for the poor program. That's really nice to hear because we have a Peruvian friend. Iceland. Okay, I'm not sure this is totally nonviolent. That's certainly not a part of restorative justice, but what they're advertising is that white-collar criminals go to jail. They had a terrific collapse economically in 2008 that almost took some of my life savings down with it, but they wouldn't take it at the last minute. Really, Iceland has done some incredible things. They have a 60-40 rule for all departments of the government and the parliament. That is a gender rule. You have to have either 60% men or 60% women. If I'm not mistaken, the prime minister is a woman at this point. They have done a lot of what people did in Argentina, which is to take over businesses that had failed. France stopped throwing away food. Mm-hmm. Défense de rejeter la nourriture. Hein? Okay. In Sweden, they have instituted a six-hour workday. There's other interesting developments in Sweden that we can go into, but we'll let our friend Maya Bengtsson fill us in on our Hope Tank on Saturday.
A six-hour workday. Wow.
Hey, don't even think of doing that at the Meta Center.
I should go hiking.
Not at the Meta Center, Stephanie. Keep your nose to the grindstone. So Portugal has done an experiment of decriminalizing drugs. Several states in the U.S. have legalized growing and selling marijuana, but this is a big expansion of that could really help some communities who've borne the brunt of prosecutions for drug problems. In Ireland, they're treating drug addiction as a health issue. In Japan, they're making children self-sufficient. Sweden, again, We Are All Feminists is the name of a program that makes male CEOs reducing their number in favor of female CEOs in Sweden.
One last one, Michael.
Okay,
one
here
last
you go.
Believe it or not,
Israel, water can be managed. And in England, for my last item, domestic abuse isn't always physical. I really like that one because it opens up the door to the new story, the discovery of the human being as mind, body, and spirit.
Now, where can people find that study that's on popular resistance?
Popularresistance.org.
Okay, great. Thank you so much to our mother station, KWMR, to all of our listeners and friends. And to the next time, everybody, take care of one another. Goodbye.
This is Parent Power Podcast, a show that explores the tools and technologies of peace to help empower nonviolent parenting and happy, secure children. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, Executive Director of the Meta Center for Nonviolence. In today's episode of Parent Power, we'll hear from Robin Wildman, a fifth grade teacher at Broad Rock Elementary School in Rhode Island, who is training her students and colleagues in Kingian nonviolence. How does she explain nonviolence to kids? First of all, we have to ask, what is Kingian nonviolence? Nonviolence is a power or a force that we all have access to from within us, and it arises from the conversion of a negative drive, like fear, jealousy, anger, resentment, into its positive counterpart, like compassion, mercy, forgiveness, or love, just to name a few. So what's Kingian about it? Kingian nonviolence, as Wildman explained, is a systematic way of unlocking Martin Luther King's vision of nonviolent action and what he coined as the beloved community, which is a world working together for the uplift of everyone. Let's turn now to Robin Wildman.
So principle one is nonviolence is a way of life for brave people. And we like to teach children that principle particularly because it takes great courage to work for peace through nonviolence. That if someone is harming you, the way to address that problem is scary sometimes. You have fear behind that. And so despite the fear, if you can tap into your courage, then you can begin to figure out a way to solve your conflict. So that's principle one. Principle two, Dr. King called that beloved community, right? So I say the peaceful community is the goal for the future, so that we are always trying to work towards creating a place wherever we are, could be a school, could be a classroom, your home, your community. That peaceful community is a place where people know how to solve their conflicts with nonviolence. Principle three is attack problems, not people. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. We always look at the root of the problem and the issues that have been brought up, and rather than harming somebody else in the process of trying to solve a conflict, we focus directly on the problem that's occurred. And then principle four is know and do what is right, even if it is difficult. And that's a great one for kids, because a lot of times we know the right thing to do. We don't necessarily always practice that. And then five is avoid hurting the spirit and body of yourself and others. That one I definitely say a lot in my classroom to my students. And the last one is the universe is on the side of justice.
This has been another episode of Parent Power Podcast. Copyright, the Meta Center for Nonviolence, 2016.